Welcome to season 14 of She Builds Podcast, where we share stories about women in the design and construction field, one lady at a time.
This season's theme is Anything Goes, a combination of regular episodes and charrettes based on anything inspiring us at the moment.
Quick reminder, we're not experts on history. We're just sharing stories about the information that we find as friends having a fun conversation.
If you find an error, send us an email and we will all continue learning.
Today, we're learning about World's Fairs, a huge temporary international exhibition designed to showcase the cultural, technological, and scientific achievements of nations. I'm Nurjiri Rivas, catching flights, not feelings, in Houston, Texas.
I'm Jessica Rogers, working hard, but traveling harder out of Miami, Florida.
Let's begin. The time was...
Wait. So we're just going to start like that?
What else am I supposed to do?
I feel like you got to give some context of why we're doing an episode about the World's Fair.
Okay, good idea. Really, World's Fairs come up a lot on our show. They're at times like a time marker, similar to how the World Wars kind of give you an idea of the time and a general sense of what's going on in the world and in someone's life when the wars come up. Just like that, the World's Fairs seem to give a sense of time and history. What were the priorities and the big inventions at the time? They talk about innovation and culture exchange. And, you know, as architects, we're really interested in that. And a lot of our ladies have either attended a World Fair or been involved in one.
Yes. Even in school, World's Fairs are things that we talked about, specifically the projects and the thoughts that came out.
Yeah. And then one day, one of us said, we should look into the history of World's Fair. Why did it start? How? Where? When? And if it's to do it now in our Anything Goes season.
Yep. I'm so excited that we finally get to dive deep into this.
I actually think it was you
who probably
said we should do a charrette. And I was like, yeah, do it, Jessica.
And then here we are. And then you did it.
Here we are. I'm going to do it. All right. I learned a lot more than I thought I would as I was developing this episode. Some of the most surprising facts for me were that, number one, other people don't call it World's Fairs. Apparently, that's mostly used in the U.S., where both Jessica and I
reside,
are from and in. But most Europeans and Asians call it the Universal Exhibitions.
Of course, there would be several names for this. And of course, the U.S. would be different.
Yes.
But I mean, this is a global event after all. So what can you expect?
Another term that's commonly used is World Expo.
Yes. Now that makes sense. And I think we've also referred to them as World Expos as well.
Yeah, I think so. That's a term we've heard before. Mm-hmm. The other thing I had no idea about was that there are four different types of World Fairs. One is the World Expo. Two is Specialized Expo. Three, the Horticultural Expo. And four is the Milan Triennale.
What? I need to know more about each of these.
Okay, I'll tell you. We'll start with the most well-known one, the World Expo.
Yes.
These are the biggest ones. They cost the most. Each participating country or company is expected to build their own pavilion. And there's always a theme that everyone has to stick to or fit into somehow.
Oh, yes. World Expos need guardrails, too, just like our show.
Yeah.
Expos are around for months at a time. Some structures that were a part of the expo would stay there forever. So I'm excited.
They used to happen whenever it tickled a country's fancy. But the governing body of World Expos, which is the International Bureau of Expositions, or BIE for its name in French, voted on it being every 5 years. This works to give countries time to build their little piggy banks to get ready to spend money on a new pavilion every 5 years. It's also a good strategy to avoid competition with the Olympics, though it's bound to happen, but it happens less.
Oh, that's a good idea. I think we might have mentioned in one of our episodes how expensive these expos can be. I forgot that people travel to see the Olympics, and I know that people also travel for the expo. So it makes sense. And it might have been more prevalent back then, but I can imagine how technology would have evolved in a 5-year span. And I can see now what new thing can emerge in the span of every 5 years. So I kind of like that. It's like a good marker.
I agree. And this type of world fair can last anywhere between 6 weeks and 6 months. It just depends.
Oh, well, there you go. 6 months as like a time span.
Now, the second type of expos are the specialized expos, and those happen in between the years of the world expos.
Wait, what? There's an in-between fair?
Yep. These are smaller, shorter, cheaper expos. They have a size constraint of no more than 62 acres or 25 hectares, and the largest pavilion can't be larger than 1/4 of an acre or 1,000 meters. They could go from 3 weeks to 3 months, so half the length of a World Expo, and the organizers have to build the pavilions and not charge the countries or companies for rent or expense, which makes them cheaper expos to participate in.
Oh, interesting. I wish they advertised these more. It seems more approachable and maybe less crowded to like attend, or even for like the smaller countries that maybe are not as wealthy to participate in.
Yeah.
I'd like to go.
Usually the pavilions are prefab structures of some kind that the host country designs and puts together. So they start out looking kind of similar, but then the countries or groups that are going to inhabit the pavilion are allowed to customize the exterior in some way. And of course, they get to fill the interior with whatever is fitting of the theme and whatever they want to showcase.
And this is where they really shine. They get to showcase their country's culture and what they're known for. It's such a cool thing to see.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I haven't told you yet that these bite-sized world fair, as I like to call it, also are centered around a specialized theme. For example, in 1988, Brisbane, Australia hosted the specialized expo Leisure in the Age of Technology. And in 2012, in South Korea, they hosted the Living Ocean and Coast.
Oh, since they are shorter and they happened in between world expos, does that mean that we get like one a year? We can have like three total?
No, there can only be one specialized expo between two world fairs. So we can't go plan a bazillion in 3 years just because they're short. No, don't go crazy.
Gotcha. We gotta cogerlo con tequerisse.
That's right. Okay. The third type of expo are the horticultural expos, which made me think of you immediately.
Why? Because of farming?
No, because you like plants and flowers.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm guessing there's also food there too, and like the fresh produce and maybe flowers and plants, like you said. So, okay.
Yeah.
That would be like the only two reasons I would attend, for food and plants on a nice cool day so that I don't get too sweaty, but also not too cold. Because my Florida blood can't handle it. Anywho, who even decides these things?
These are governed by the BEIE and the International Association of Horticultural Producers. They're put together to encourage people from agricultural and horticultural industries from all over the world to cooperate together, share their knowledge and solutions to all sorts of green thumb problems, like green economy, sustainability, healthy living, and overall education and innovation around these subjects.
Actually, I really like this.
I thought you would.
Yeah.
Just like every expo we've talked about so far, there's always an overarching theme. Two recent ones are building a beautiful home featuring harmonious coexistence between man and nature. That was Expo 2019 in Beijing, China, and Green Desert, Better Environment, which was Expo 2023 in Doha, Qatar.
Ooh, those sounds like really lovely exhibits. Gosh, that would have been so fun to visit, those themes. They sound so cool.
Yeah, we should look up the next one.
Yeah.
Arc Venture.
Mm-hmm.
And last but not the least expo is the Milan Triennale. This one happens every 3 years at a museum in Milan with the same name, and it's done to celebrate and expose architecture, art, and industrial design to the world.
I think this one is probably what we know the most, maybe.
Actually, I've never heard of this one. I know the Venice Biennale, which is different and not under the umbrella of the BIE. Is that what you're thinking about?
Yes, that's what I'm thinking about. So two separate things.
Two separate things. I had to look it up too. I was like, is this a typo? But nope, it's not a typo. There is a Milan.
Different city, different ex.
Different yep. Everything.
Different everything.
All right. Now that I've shared all the different kinds of expos recognized by the International Bureau of Expositions, may I start the story on World Expos, Jessica?
Wait, you haven't started?
No, you didn't let me before. I got to do my little intro thing.
Ah, okay. Yes, you may begin.
Okay. The time was 1791. The place, Clementium, in the city of Prague, in the Kingdom of Bohemia. What we know today as the Czech Republic. The first world fair was born.
Ooh, why there? Why then?
Well, it was to celebrate the coronation of Leopold II as King of Bohemia, to show off the sophisticated manufacturing methods in the region during that time.
Oh, so this was strategic. Because Leopold succeeded his brother Joseph II, who was not popular. It was a rough time to be the king of Bohemia. He was surrounded by a future French Revolution and a Russia that was all too eager to sweep in and take his lands. Also, compared to Joseph, Leopold was seen as a moderate reformer. He abolished capital punishment and worked on leading his reign into modernity, which makes sense why he would organize a world fair to show off their technology.
Right.
Also, fun fact, he was Marie Antoinette's brother. Maybe not so fun because we know what happened there.
Yeah, right again. Well, speaking of France, France caught the bug and was like, I want to do a fair too. So 7 years later, France started throwing national fairs that they called Exhibition of Products of French Industry. And this was kind of during the French Revolution. So I'm taking leaps. And I'm going to say, I think that they were trying to lighten up their image, maybe. But I don't know. I really didn't look too deep into this. I'm making assumptions. The official reason why they did it is because they wanted to show off what they were doing and hope people would come see, learn, and possibly take home some ideas to develop further.
What exactly were they showing off?
Oh, my goodness. A whole bunch of stuff, like a fancy clock, a tool for cataract operations, a machine that turned iron into steel, paintings made of the feathers of exotic birds, a precision balance, a machine for taking logs from rivers, and a device that demonstrated the new metric system of meters, grams, and liters.
It was a world of innovation, a new metric system. Like, come on.
Yeah, well, it's the metric system that we know.
Well...
They just invented a device to measure it. Anyway.
Oh.
It opened on September 19, 1798, and it lasted only 5 days, though it remained open until October. The architect, Jean-François Chalgrin, was tasked with designing a space for this grand affair. He built a temple of industry surrounded by circles of large porticos.
Ooh, cool. Are there photos? Maybe I'll just wait to see the show notes to see if they're there.
Check out the show notes.
Oh, there you go.
Fun fact, Jean-François is the architect of the little architectural jewel called the Arc de Triomphe.
Not the Arc de Triomphe. I thought his name was familiar because I just assumed it reminded us of our architectural history teacher in Syracuse, whose name was also Jean-François. But he was French-Canadian, and apparently there's like a difference between French-Canadian and French-French. Anyway, for this to be the first one in France, I can also imagine that this was like a big ordeal of an event.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes, it was. The grand opening was a big deal with parades, musicians, soldiers marching, politicians making speeches, everything.
I wouldn't expect anything less.
At first, the French kept hosting their national exhibitions every year or so, but then there were some long gaps due to wars and stuff. What are you going to do? In the end, there were 11 expos from 1798 to 1849.
Okay, that's understandable.
Other European countries started hosting national exhibitions, and then in 1851, Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, had the idea to host the Great Exhibition of the Works of Industry of All Nations. That's a really long name. They needed someone to brand this,
yeah,
but okay.
Yeah.
Allegedly, 44 nations participated. The Crystal Palace in Hyde Park, London, was built to host this event.
All right. So you could have heard about the Crystal Palace in architecture school. So the Crystal Palace was basically a giant glass and iron building. It was plopped right into Hyde Park for this 1851 World's Fair. So like imagine this massive greenhouse on steroids, okay? Transparent walls, a soaring roof, even full-grown trees were inside. It was huge, okay? We're talking, it was like about 1,850 feet long. Big enough to fit cathedrals, crowds, and exhibits from all over the world without even having each other feel cramped. And what made it wild for the time was how fast it went up and how modern it felt. Prefab parts, tons of light, and nothing like the heavy stone buildings people were used to.
Thank you for that description.
Yeah, brings me back.
Yeah, I really liked this one in school.
Me too.
Some consider that this one we're talking about right now was the first World Fair because they not only invited the world to come attend, but also to participate.
Ah, yes. Okay, now it's starting to appear like how we know it to be now.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, designers and curious minds. Ever wondered about the stories hiding within your building's walls? I'm Carrie Seaburn, structural engineer and host of Unstruct, the podcast that decodes and simplifies major concepts of structural design. Behind the math and physics, structural engineering simply predicts building behavior. Join me as we simplify the complex, making structural design accessible to everyone.
Nowadays, instead of measuring it via cost, we're saying, well, what about carbon, you know? We've got two levers now that we can, if an architect has an inefficient design, we can hit them with two levers, if you like.
The official casualty figure is 55,000. Everybody I talked to told me that the actual figure is at least three times as much. And I believe that. I mean, seeing what I saw, Turkish codes are good and they have been improving, but compliance was completely lacking.
Fluent in steel, concrete, masonry, and timber design, I'll bring you leading engineers to dissect the tales behind their building structure. Whether you're an architect, contractor, engineer, or just love a good story, this podcast is for you.
Yeah, beam penetrations. That's a fun topic on this project.
Follow the link in the show notes to subscribe to Unstruct. From within your walls, hear the story behind how your building stands today.
From then on, other expos followed the same suit to be spaces for state-of-the-art science and technology and inventions from all over the world.
Like which ones?
The one we just talked about in London, 1851, introduced the fax machine. And the world learned about the telephone and Heinz ketchup at the 1876 Philadelphia World Fair. Architectural and engineering marvels like the Eiffel Tower and the Ferris wheel came to life in 1889 Paris and 1893 Chicago, respectively. Oh, also we can thank this Chicago one for the invention of the automatic dishwasher and the zipper.
Mm.
You know? It's so funny because, like, these things don't sound that amazing anymore, but
at the time, it was revolutionary.
They were. Yeah. And I mean, they're still so important today. My pants would fall off.
And I love a dishwasher, okay? Because who's got time to wash dishes?
Agreed.
And zippers.
Love the sippers. In 1939, New York, we got the TV. And I gotta say, this is one of my favorite inventions.
Yes, thank you.
In 1962, Seattle gave us another architectural icon, the Space Needle. And in 1970, Osaka, we got the IMAX film and wireless phones. And the list goes on and on and on, honestly.
Wait, I'm just like putting two and two together. We all know these places and things like the Space Needle, the, you know, Crystal Palace. I seriously had no idea where all they stemmed from. Like,
yeah, they were built for the fairs. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I got a little ahead of myself there. I'm sorry. Let's go back to London, 1851.
Okay, we are there.
After that one, as you could maybe tell from the list I just blurted out, a bunch of world fairs started happening all over the place. And then in 1928, the nations were like, hey, this expo thing is really catching on. Let's organize a meeting to talk about this, come up with ground rules of what is and what is not a world expo. So they did just that, and they very precisely named it Convention Relating to International Exhibitions.
You know, that's right. You know, we got to put these guardrails up, like I mentioned earlier. Or if not, these exhibitions will be all willy-nilly.
Mm-hmm. At the end of the convention, the International Bureau of Expositions, or BIE, for its name in French, like I said before, was born. And they are still going strong as the sanctioning body for international exhibitions.
Yeah. Okay, listen to how they describe what an expo is. Expos are global events dedicated to finding solutions to fundamental challenges facing humanity by offering a journey inside a chosen theme through engaging and immersive activities, organized and facilitated by governments and bringing together countries and international organizations, official participants. These major public events are unrivaled in their ability to gather millions of visitors, creating new dynamics and catalyst change in their host cities.
That's beautiful.
Yeah, I got it from their website. Listeners, check out our show notes for a link to their website to learn more about this organization.
Yeah, and their website is cool. They have a list of all the recognized world expos, and the logos for each are really cool. Cool.
Yeah, guys, you all should check this out. Because it's interesting to see, like, how ornate they are and how they become less and less ornate. The one that stood out to me was the one from Port-au-Prince. It's from 1949. First, it came after the New York Expo, which was, like, starting to become all, like, modern and stuff. And also, I had no idea that Port-au-Prince hosted a World's Fair. Like, who knew?
Yeah. This World Expo era, if you will, from 1851 to 1938, today is known as the industrialization era of world's fairs because they all centered around that. And it's basically the character that the world fairs are most recognized to be. Like, that's how we think of world's fair. And I mean, I didn't even think that there would be any other characters or types.
Oh my gosh, that is so true. We are like, what, 20 or so minutes in, and I've learned so much.
The most famous world's fairs of this time were held between Europe and the US. And if you remember, half of the cool inventions that I told you before were from those years.
That's right.
Then something happened in 1939.
World War II.
Well, yes. But for the first time ever, that's not what I'm going to say about this year.
Oh, okay. Well, hopefully it's going to be good.
Yeah, it's not bad. Though World War II sets the bar so low, as low as it can go, that yeah. Anything after that sounds like sunshine and rainbows.
Yeah, that's true. But okay, now I'm just curious of what would happen other than World War II.
Okay, in 1939, April 30 to be exact, before World War II started, New York opened their World's Fair. And the theme was Building the World of Tomorrow, which sounds like it's about technology, but it was mostly focused on social progress.
Yes. Okay. I mean, I just mentioned it. I just didn't put the years together because I had just mentioned that the Port-au-Prince World's Fair came after this one. And now their logo makes sense because this was you know, it's a little bit more modern. Now, this New York World's Fair was massive as well. It was over 1,200 acres, so it's slightly less than London, but still pretty big. Its iconic symbols were the trilon and the perisphere, a weird but cool spire and spear combo that screamed futuristic in a very like 1930s way. Think World of Tomorrow. That's the image that would pop up. Inside, you would see things like General Motors' Futurama, which basically predicted highways, suburbs, and like a very car-centric city decades before that became like a real thing. So I guess to your point, Najee, what makes this significant is that even though it opened on the edge of World War II, the fair was something that was widely hopeful. Bright lights, sleek forms, and the belief that progress could fix just about anything. Like you said, it wasn't about showing like the gadgets and the technology. It was about creating this vision of how people thought the future should look and feel.
From that World Fair forward, the approach was more centered on intercultural communication, adding on to sharing of innovation and technological stuff. We've entered the cultural exchange era.
Oh, I love to see it.
A great example from this era is the 1967 International and Universal Exposition in Montreal, where the theme was Man and His World.
Ooh, interesting. I like where we're heading.
Mm-hmm. It was this fair that made the term expo more popular, though it was already being used in Europe. The Montreal Fair was advertised as Expo 67. This might be my favorite expo because it gave us Habitat 67.
That's right. Habitat 67. We've talked about Habitat 67 and how, you know, we, some of us, kind of broke into it for our venture once upon a time. But it's an iconic residential complex in Montreal, Canada, designed by the esteemed Moshi Safdie. Habitat 67 is a pavilion for Expo 67. The expo itself is considered to be one of the most successful expos because based on a single day attendance of 567,000 attendants would appear in one day. We've mentioned it a couple of times because we really like it.
Yeah, and since we don't get tired of talking about it, let's talk about it again.
Yeah. It's one of the most famous brutalist buildings, and y'all know how much Najee and I love some brutalist architecture.
We really do.
Yeah, it's made up of 354 stacked concrete cubes. Concrete. My heart is still. No, we love some concrete. It's creating 146 apartments, each with a private garden on the roof below. God, I wish we could have snuck in some more. We didn't get that far when we snuck in. I wanted to see some of that.
No, not at all. I don't think it even constituted as trespassing.
But we still got kicked out.
We did?
Yes. There was a group of us and we were like walking. We were like about to get in deep. And then the guy was like, what are you guys here for? Like, you guys can't be here.
Excuse me.
And it's like, but we're architecture students. Please, please let us look.
I've blocked it out.
I just never have been kicked out of anywhere. But I was that day.
Oh my goodness. Well, did you know that it started out as a thesis of how to combine the density of a city with the greenery and living conditions of a suburb, aiming to blend urban density with suburban living?
Imagine if our architecture school thesis projects would have got built.
Imagine. That would have been so cool. Mine was about conciliatory architecture between users and the Big Brother surveillance world we're living in. What was yours?
Mine was a redesign of the Miami History Museum in a way that makes you avoid looking down on your phone. Over 10 years ago, and our thoughts are still so relevant today.
They really are.
Yeah.
But also, what I find really cool about Habitat 67 is that it's still, like, people
operational.
Live there today. Yeah.
That's why we got kicked out, because it's
exactly.
A private residence.
There you go. There's probably like an Airbnb we could do there.
We could also probably formally ask for a tour instead of just walking in.
All right. Well, back to the cultural exchange era of World Expos. This one lasted from 1939 to 1987.
Ooh, okay. So what came next?
The national branding era from 1988 to today.
Huh?
Okay. At and after World Expo 88 in Brisbane, historians noticed a new trend. Countries were using their pavilions to improve their national image, which had always been like a plus, something countries did, but all of a sudden it became more of the focus, more than it had been before.
Oh, like a form of like propaganda.
Yeah, you could say that.
Mm-hmm.
A study showed that Spain used Expo 92 in Barcelona to push the image that they were a democratic and important country of the European Union. And by Expo 2000, Hanover, over 700 of the participating countries' main priority was for their pavilion to show off their country and improve their national image, according to that study, which I will link on the show notes.
Beautiful. That's interesting because it makes you wonder like what this tells you about society and like our perception or how we want to be perceived.
It does.
And in this way, it's a country form. But yeah.
And these pavilions ain't cheap, honey. I'm talking millions of dollars. So it's become a thing where some countries are asking themselves, what's the return on investment on this?
I mean, sure. But I can also imagine that countries want to showcase how much wealth they have. So they're just like making it rain, you know, like we got money.
Yeah. It's still obviously worth it because countries keep doing it.
Yeah.
The last one just happened in 2020 in Osaka, Japan.
Nope, 2025.
That's right. Supposedly for Expo 2000, the Netherlands spent more than 30 million euros on their pavilion. But if you think that number's big, allegedly it generated 350 million euros in potential revenue for their country. Though, how the heck they measure that, please don't ask me.
I feel like this is the equivalent of the World Cup, the FIFA World Cup. Now that it's in the US this year or whatever coming up, I feel like that's been a topic of discussion of like how much income this is or revenue this is going to generate, but also how much the cost it is to like build stadiums and what have you.
Yeah. I also think of the Olympics, right? This is also something that is talked about during the Olympics.
Yeah.
Well, the next World Fair is Expo 2030, and it's going to happen in Riyadh, Saudi Arabia.
So if we're talking about future Expo, I'm guessing we reached the end of our story.
We have.
Okay. I guess it's good that we have something to look forward to. It's refreshing to end a story without like a death and we're looking towards the future.
It is the beauty of a anything goes season.
Yep. And, you know, the beauty of these expos, now that we know that it's in 2030 and it's going to be in Saudi Arabia, we have enough time today to start saving monies so that we can go. Future ARC venture in the future.
Burr, 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 burr. Well, I really enjoyed this charrette. Hope all of you out there listening enjoyed it too. Please let us know what topics you would like us to have a charrette on, and you might hear a future episode based on your suggestion.
Before we say goodbye, we also want to say thank you to CMYK for the music, John W., our technical advisor, and most of all, thank you for listening.
Remember to check out our show notes for links and further information on this charrette.
Please let us know what you thought of our episode. If you enjoyed it, please help us spread the word. Tell your friends, your colleagues, tell them all. Also, give us 5 stars on iTunes and Spotify. And write us a review, please.
Your support means everything to us. If you've enjoyed our content and want other ways to help us with our mission, you can support us by visiting our website for merchandise.
If you don't need any more swag, but you'd still like to consider supporting the research we're doing, you can donate to us on our website at shebuildspodcast.com/donate, or you can buy us coffee at buymecoffee.com/shebuildspodcast. You can also find links to all of these items on our website.
She Builds Podcast is a member of the Gable Media Podcast Network. Gable Media is curated thought leadership for an audience dedicated to building a better world. Listen and subscribe to all the shows at gablemedia.com. That's GABLmedia.com.
We are excited to hear from you and for you to come back and keep learning about bosses with us. You can email us your thoughts at shebuildspodcast@gmail.com. Leave a comment on our website, shebuildspodcast.com, or follow us on Instagram and Facebook at shebuildspodcast and on X at shebuildspod. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.